Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 28th day of March, 2020. And no doubt about it, that's at least a week or more now into what should be called post-constitutional America. I've been calling it America with a K for quite some time, but anybody who's up until now doubted that the old republic was on life support no longer has any excuse for not smelling the coffee and the stench of a police state. I'm your host, Mark Call, and we're going to go into some detail tonight about what that means. The important thing to remember is we are just seeing the tip of the iceberg, and yeah, the old Bachman-Turner Overdrive song is appropriate. You ain't seen nothing yet. The way I will put it at this point is that a system that has been designed, engineered, enhanced, and literally tuned to perfection in order to fail, now has. The just-in-time delivery system, the biggest debt and credit bubble in human history, the fiat money system, where the entire world does not have a single currency which is anything but money printed out of nothing, most of it based on the almighty fiat U.S. dollar, all of those things are now coming apart at the seams. The trouble is, most people don't recognize it, and ultimately, here's an expression almost everybody's heard. I'll try to clean it up. T-S-H-T-F, right? We all know what that means. If you don't, it's when the stuff, or something even browner, has hit the fan. And I have joked about it for years, saying, hey, at the point where you turn around and look at the wall and there's a man or woman-shaped cutout on the wall, everything else is brown, you know that it's already happened. So turn around, take a look. Yeah, it already has. Now, that brings me to where I want to start off today, and that is a discussion that I've had not once, not twice. I've even lost track at least three or four times over just the last week. And before that, it's been something that I'm sure almost everybody listening has had or thought about at least one time or another, and that is the following. Well, how will we know when the you-know-what has hit the fan? Most people assume it'll be obvious, and everybody will recognize it. Now, maybe we had a sign, a harbinger of things to come, when people went into a panic buying rolls of toilet paper so they could presumably starve to death, but maybe still wipe their you-know-what. That's an indication of panic, but it doesn't necessarily mean that people have awakened to it. So the discussion goes something like this, and again, I've had this any number of times. There are those of us here in the place where yours truly is located, where there are a whole lot of people that would call themselves preppers or those who have come out or those that just want to be in a more rural environment, want to be off-grid, want to be more self-sufficient. Whatever you call it, there have been any number of neighbors and others that I've talked to that are saying, okay, look, I got my son that's in New York. I got my cousin or my sister on the eastern seaboard somewhere. I got relatives in California, and I can't talk them into leaving. Why, for crying out loud, can't people see what's going on and say, hey, it's get your bug-out bag. It's time to load up the car and get out of Dodge. And the answer is, they won't go. And oftentimes, right, we've all seen and experienced this. It's a mother who says, well, I'm not going to leave without my kids. It's a brother who says, okay, I may leave the rest of my family, but I sure want to talk them into coming out here. It's fathers who have been separated from their kids because the kids have grown up and moved on to jobs and so forth, but are now saying, hey, you know, you better wake up and realize what's already happened. Oh, gee, Dad. Oh, gee, Mom. It's no big deal. I'll get out of here if there's ever a problem. Well, by the time the roads are closed, the National Guard's called out, and you're told you can't leave, it might be too late. Well, what if the food riots happen then? What if the roving gangs of cannibal rapists happen then? Oh, it's a little bit late, isn't it? Now, I've got stories, by the stacks sitting on my desk from some good people who have been writing about what's coming for years, saying, well, you know what, folks? It's too late to prep. Those that have been prepping and getting ready for what's now here for years are fine to the extent that they have adequate supplies of food and weapons and all kinds of other things. Those that are in a state of panic are probably exactly where they intended to be, which is panicking. And then there are those that are just plain ignorant, don't have a clue what's happened, and they will be up until the point where they're, let's just say, meat on somebody's table or worse. And yeah, there are probably things that are worse. So, I know that's a scary way to start things off, but essentially what I'm heading for is this. All of us have had this frustration of saying, for crying out loud, can't you see what's coming? Can't you recognize that history maybe doesn't repeat precisely, but it rhymes? Haven't we seen this before? Haven't we seen lead-ins to hyperinflation before? Haven't we seen government overreach before? Haven't we seen totalitarian measures being put in place temporarily? Well, like the Patriot Act, like all kinds of things called the Anti-Terror Act decades ago. Getting people used to, slowly boiling the frog, ready for what is now being unleashed. But hey, it's not that much worse than what we've already seen and gotten used to. Your papers bitta? Well, no, you better just not travel. Can't leave. Stay home. Achtung verboten. And with all of that in mind, I want to tell a story that occurred to me when I was having one of these discussions earlier in the week. And I hope it's a good analogy. I hope people will follow it. I know that a lot of you aren't pilots, obviously. But it's one of those things that's kind of shaped my understanding, my view of the world. I've been I grew up in a household where my father was a pilot, so I was exposed to aviation, airplanes, everything from small puddle jumper singles to twins to even biz jets and the like, because my dad was a corporate pilot for a while, too. Then when I got to be, in my 20s, I finally got around to getting a pilot's license, and I discovered a whole lot of things. One of which is that flying is probably one of the, best remaining things that an individual can do in the 21st century that will expose them to the concept of true life or death responsibility. I've told the story many times of my first solo. When I made several good landings, been flying for a while with my instructor, and finally he says, here, pull off the side of the runway. And I said, what? He says, yeah, just pull off. And he opened the door, got out, and says, I've had enough for today. You take it around. And I had expected that there was going to be a time when I would get my my solo opportunity, but not quite at that point anyway. And I took off, and I was supposed to make a couple of runs around the pattern. Took off, turned, went into the downwind, and then finally turned base and final, did my pre-landing checklist, and I looked over for the very, very first time in my flying career at an empty right seat. And it suddenly hit me. I mean, this is truly what you call a significant emotional event. I'm looking over there, and I'm realizing there is nobody on this planet, not one living soul who is going to put this plane safely on the runway, but the guy sitting right here in my seat, and I better do it right. And I did, and it was a wonderful, literally joyful, a kind of a transformative experience. Because then, after that, you get your license and you realize, okay, when I take this plane up, I have responsibility for the lives of the people that are here with me, that have trusted me to fly them. And furthermore, this is kind of interesting, federal aviation regulations literally say that the pilot in command, it's a legal term, of the airplane has life or death responsibility and as such literally has the authority to override any aviation regulations if necessary in an emergency to get that plane safely on the ground along with its passengers and prevent loss of life and even property. And all of this is a big deal. It's a transformative thing. Kind of helps you understand the responsibility that all of us have when we look out at a world and a society and an economy that's coming apart at the seams and say, you know what? If we don't make the right decisions today, that too is a life or death, success or failure. It's just that it's not quite as immediate. Obviously, if you screw up and leave the gear up or do something stupid and you bend metal, as the popular expression goes, the pilot in command is responsible. Well, what about when a family won't go where it needs to go and people die as a result? Maybe all of them. Well, maybe it's not immediate. Well, all of those things kind of lead me to tell this other story. So literally, I've been leading up to this one. And this is a hypothetical. Thankfully, I have never had this experience, although honestly, every pilot has practiced it dozens, if not hundreds of times. And it goes something like this. Okay, you can kind of probably understand where I'm headed. We're flying cross-country, and I'm in the airplane, got some people with me, and we're at, this is an easy number to do the math with. We're at 10,000 feet above the ground. Call it about 2 miles high. And people think, oh, that's really high. Isn't it scarier to be higher? No. There's an old saying in aviation that the higher you are, as a general rule, the safer you are. Why? Well, because you've got a lot further before you could possibly hit the ground. A lot more time, a lot more distance. All of that is part of safety. So let's suppose we're flying around and heading cross-country somewhere, and the engine fails. Oh, no, we're all going to... No, that's not really... It's a problem. Yes, it's the kind of thing where a pilot would declare an emergency on the radio, not necessarily the first thing you do. There are checklists and things that we practiced. Can we restart the engine and so forth? How about let's find a place to land just in case I can't restart the engine? All right, all of those are things that I don't want to dwell on. What I do want to point out is the following. Hey, you know what, folks? As I get ready to tell the story, the engine of the economy has died. It's dead. Stick a fork in it. Let me say that again. The engine on the economy has died. It is dead. It's not coming back. Yeah, you'll hear otherwise. Guess what? They're lying. Once the bubble pops, you don't put air back into it. The Fed can print trillions. Oh, and they will. And it's not going to be enough. And ultimately, it'll end where all such money printing exercises in human history always have. Hyperinflation. Well, we'll come back to that. But for now, let's just think about the fact that here we are flying along and the engine is out. We're a couple miles high above the ground. Well, gee, what does that mean? Well, here's an interesting point. Your typical airplane, let's just say for purposes of argument, a good airplane might have a glide ratio of about 10 to 1. What that means is that for every foot you go down, you can glide about 10 feet forward. So if I'm 2 miles high, that means, well, in the absence of wind, I can glide about 20 miles. That's a radius. That means that in the literally 40-mile diameter area below me, who knows how many airports there are? Well, it'd be important to know that, wouldn't it? And if there aren't airports, I guarantee you there are lots of places, even in a mountainous area, in almost all certainty, where I can land that airplane, especially the one that I had that was a stole airplane that would land literally practically in a parking lot if you needed to, safely. So let's go back to where we're at. 2 miles high, and we've got at least 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. We've got a lot of time before anything bad is going to happen. Don't panic. If you panic, things that are bad happen immediately, and that's much like the current situation, too. And I've got a radius of at least 10, maybe 20 miles to pick from. I can use my GPS nowadays, or before this, I would have been conscious and aware of where various airports were that I knew about. Could call on the radio and ask. Bear in mind that if there's a good wind, the wind will move me further in one direction than another, so that's kind of important as far as picking where I want to go. But I can take my time, literally, you're going to do this expeditiously, obviously, but not in a panic, and decide what I want to do, where we're going to go. Here's the point. This is back to the families again. All of the youngsters, particularly 20, 30-year-olds that think, oh, nothing bad could ever happen. What's happened today is what's going to happen tomorrow. Nothing to worry about. Hey, there'll be plenty of time. Well, there is plenty of time, but sometimes you have to realize the engine's out. You better start making your move. We have 5 to 10 minutes, 10 to 20 miles to make the changes, to make the adjustments that we need to make. Now, at this point, if the situation were real, I would be talking to the passengers and saying things like, you know, put your tray tables and seat backs in the upright position. Make sure you see, you know, you've heard all the stories. Get yourself ready for a possible hard landing. No, it doesn't mean put your head between your knees and you know what. It simply means get ready. Now, one of the things that I usually tell passengers, or they know by the time we've flown a few times, is if there really is a situation, I'm going to just give orders. I don't expect to have to explain why. I just tell you to do something. You better do it. Okay? It's a pilot in command authority. One of the orders that I'll give just before we touch down, and this is kind of an interesting one, is open the doors. What? Yeah, crack the doors. Why? Well, no, I'm not going to answer why. Just do it. And then later, if the plane ends up inverted because, you know, we hit something or spun around hitting a tree or a power line or whatever and had to flip, well, and we're upside down, that's not necessarily a problem. But isn't it nice that the doors are open because they aren't jammed shut if bent metal happens? So these are all things that are important to talk about, to think about in advance, including just knowing that if the pilot in command gives an order, do it. And then worry about what it was and why later. The point, of course, is the following. We have what looks like a very serious situation. No cause for panic, but it certainly does mean make a move. Now, ideally, right, a decent pilot will have been prepared for this. A decent prepper will have said, hey, what are the kind of things that are likely to happen? From a bioweapons attack to an EMP to a power grid failure to an economic meltdown. We're getting several of those all at once at this point. We'll almost certainly see more. Don't panic. If we've planned in advance, if we've practiced for the emergency situation, there's nobody even going to be hurt, much less need to die, at least in the airplane situation, again, if you do it right. Now, back to the families again, because this, I think, is the real key. This is the point that I hope telling this story will help those of you who are dealing with similar situations to understand. Talking to the kids, talking to the brother-in-law, talking to the parents, whatever it might be, hey, what's it going to take? How long until you wake up and realize what's going on? Don't panic, but understand, the engine's out. The engine in this particular economic airplane is out. This plane is going to land. Maybe a hard landing. It's going to come down, though. And the question is, where and how are we going to deal with it? And obviously, here's the real key, it's important to do it right. As a pilot, I want to make sure I'm going to make a good landing with an engine out. And we practice that, too. And there are things you have understood in advance, right? Am I going to use flaps? Am I not going to use flaps? Well, it all depends on where I'm going to end up landing, what the winds are, a lot of things. I'm going to practice and think about the scenario so that when the time comes, given the situation at hand, we'll know it. All right, let me ask one other metaphorical question about this hypothetical situation. Hey, does it matter? And I've been talking about this for a long time. I even said it today. This system, this economic system, has been designed to fail. No doubt about it. Just-in-time delivery is a bad fix waiting for the problem we now have. Supply chain breaks down. You got problems. You can't deliver product. People are told shelter in place at home. Well, that's kind of a really stupid, suicidal thing to do, but it guarantees you've got economic problems. The system is broken. The engine has, in fact, been sabotaged. You know what? It might be as you're making your glide slope, you think, this really irritates me, to put it mildly. Somebody messed with my engine, you know, put sugar in there, and now I'm having to land, might lose my airplane as a result. Thankfully, hopefully, nobody will be hurt here. But does it matter if the engine was sabotaged at that point? Well, actually, no. Not then. Later, you betcha. Later on, we may take some severe actions. Or at least we'll know who not to trust next time around. And that, of course, ought to be clear for a number of reasons. All right, with all of that on the table, what I want to talk about today is not just the issue of what are we going to do now that we know the engine's out, that the economy is, in fact, in the dumper, and it's not going to come back in spite of all the happy talk you're going to hear. Given that the desire is not to panic, you don't tell people everything you know. I guarantee you, folks, if the airplane loses an engine, that's going to be kind of obvious. Silence in the cockpit makes the passengers aware. Hey, what's that lack of sound? But it doesn't mean I have to engender panic. I'm going to try to exude a quiet confidence that says, there's no problem here. We're just going to make a safe landing. And all of that's true. So that puts people that are actually honest, like hopefully, but not for sure, the president, in kind of a tough spot. He can't say, the engine has been sabotaged, the plane is going down, and there's going to be a lot of people die. He has to put on a happy face and try to pretend to be a good pilot and navigate this thing to a safe landing. But I do wish he'd be more honest about the fact that, no, the engine's not going to restart, and the plane is going to end up somewhere in a ditch or a field or maybe even on a concrete runway if the big brother types that are trying to destroy things and keep sabotaging the plane don't continue to put it down somewhere else and kill a lot more people. With that in mind, I got a couple of quick stories to kind of set up where I want to go next. How about this one? I've mentioned this several times of late because it really bugs me, but it ought to be on our minds. The evil Rahm Emanuel, just before the inauguration of the Obama regime back in 2008, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, famously said, "Never let a perfectly good crisis go to waste." And he pointed out, hey, you know, us totalitarians, although he didn't say it that way, well, we're able to get away with things in a crisis that we couldn't get away with otherwise. Isn't that clever? Just before the latest the only multi-trillion dollar bailout bill in U.S. history, a real scumbag, majority whip, socialist James Clyburn, let the cat out of the bag, said a number of stories, during a Democrat caucus conference call, when he said that the coronavirus is, quote, a tremendous opportunity to restructure things to fit our vision, unquote. Well, there you go. Yeah, never let a perfectly good crisis go to waste. We will intend and accomplish greater power grabs than we could have ever done without a oh-so-convenient meltdown. Along the same lines, we had a number of stories. Kaiser Permanente, California, is literally talking about firing nurses that would dare to wear N95 masks. Because Achtung, you know, hey, you know, we're paying you to kill yourselves here. We don't want you panicking the patients by trying to see that, a mask might be helpful. This is asinine, folks. This is the kind of stuff you go, come on, are these people really stupid? Are they trying to spread the virus? Are they trying to sabotage the engine? Kind of looks like it, doesn't it? How about this one? Nevada's governor, a scumbag named Steve Sisolak, earlier this week, issued an emergency order banning the use of a drug that the president has been touting, actually two drugs, that might actually have a very high, I've even seen cases claiming 100% success rate at treating coronavirus patients, chloroquine and other things, azithromycin. Well, whether that's the way you'd want to be treated or not doesn't matter. The point is, that's been banned in Nevada because why? It works? What's the problem here? Oh, no, it's not approved by the FDA. And if Big Brother God FDA doesn't approve it, well, we'd rather have people die than experiment with something and realize their life has been saved, but Big Brother didn't do it. That seems like it might be the real disaster. Does that give us another indication of just exactly what's really going on here, what the agenda is? And then with that, I'm going to go to one other story, and I just saw this one literally a couple minutes before I got the show ready today. It comes from a guy that I've read before via LouRockwell.com, Gary D. Barnett. And he, too, is worried about the panic of the pandemic, saying the U.S. government's what need to be stopped right now. Yeah, there's an enormous amount of speculation and studies, hypotheses concerning who done it, bioweapon, was it United States that did it, China did it, was the deep state in United States in cahoots with China, who knows. But the point here he says, do not allow the virus hype to cause blindness to the clear and increasingly obvious hidden agendas of Big Brother and their methods for achieving dominance over the populace. Yeah, don't let that perfectly good crisis go to waste. Things are moving very quickly. Every single new piece of legislation, every single executive order, all these mandated tyrannical measures instituted at any level of government, from the state to the county to the local to the federal, all of them could and almost certainly will have very dangerous underlying consequences, precedents. And probably the waste stream isn't going to talk about them much either, which is why it's important to seek out those that are researching what's really going on and the tyrannical measures that are being foisted by the likes of the number three whip in the House and, those that worship at the altar of Rahm Emanuel about not letting this perfectly good crisis go to waste. Furthermore, he says the asinine social changes, they're not going to go away anytime either. Soon. It was, for example, the immigrant invasion, the blind eye that was turned towards all kinds of people that are still streaming across the borders, carrying who knows what diseases, coronavirus among them, burdening the system, pooping on the street, pardon my bluntness, but that's what San Francisco is all about nowadays, becoming rat-infested holes like Los Angeles. You want a breeding ground for feces-infested transmission of nasty viruses? Well, look at New York, look at Los Angeles, look at the entire left coast and say, hey, where did you expect this stuff to come and spread out from? We also have the new surveillance state of America, which a lot of folks, including yours truly, have been suggesting is literally becoming one giant TSA center intent on inspecting and controlling Achtung all movement and action nationwide. In other words, says Barnett, life in this country is about to become one big airport security line with the grope ups and pat downs, and that'll be the norm unless we respond, and very soon. Furthermore, he says, what's already happened is almost beyond the realm of imagination. But there's more, and we'll pick it up there when we get back. We'll be right back.
I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free. You can't take the sky from me.
Welcome back now, folks, to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall. But lest you think we're talking about the coronavirus and the hysteria surrounding it, we're really not. No, it's the response. It's the heavy-handed totalitarian Achtung response of Big Brother that is the bigger issue. And, of course, in between the COVID-19 panic and the ultimate totalitarian Big Brother state that we've seen telegraphed literally for years now, lies the economic meltdown that's going to help them bring all of this about. And, of course, that economic meltdown is baked in the cake at this point. Let me say it again. The engine has failed. This airplane, to use the metaphor I explained in the first segment, is going to land somewhere. The question is it going to land hard? Is it going to simply auger in and turn into a ball of flames because of incompetence or suicide or literally sabotage at the highest levels? I didn't mention this, but suppose, and I remember this happening years ago in Boulder, Colorado, when I was a student pilot, there was actually a case of suicide by student. There was a guy that went up with an instructor, rented an airplane, and, I won't talk about the religion of the individual involved, but if I remember correctly, the point was he wanted to kill himself and an instructor and hopefully take some people on the ground out with him. Yeah, it does happen. And yeah, if you think about it, that metaphor is sadly apropos too. I have been referring for a while now, especially starting the last few days, to literally an America on Suicide Watch. And a number of people, not just your host, but people like John W. Whitehead, that's also been writing about the constitutional abominations that have been going on for years and accelerating. He said it this way in a piece entitled Suspending the Constitution, the police state expands its lockdown powers, that everything I've warned about for years, government overreach, invasive surveillance, martial law, abuse of powers, militarized police, weaponized technology used to track and control the citizenry, and so on, has all coalesced into this present moment. Again, the engine is out, and the question is, will the landing be safe? Will there be people with cool heads that will actually enable some to survive and to rebuild? Or is this one an America that is so intent on suicide that it's going to do whatever it takes to spread the virus, destroy the economy, and build an unrecognizable thing in its place? The government's shameless exploitation of past national emergencies, said Whitehead, for its own nefarious purposes, gee, isn't that obvious, literally pales in comparison to what's presently unfolding. Back to the piece from Gary Barnett that I was interrupted during the break. He started to say, well, what's happened already is almost beyond the realm of imagination. Yeah, the you-know-what has hit the fan. But clearly, more government tyranny is on the horizon. Authoritarian measures in place now. You can rest assured, have they ever repealed the Patriot Act, the TSA, the Anti-Terror Act, the government surveillance, the we don't need no stinking warrant, or even the Fed? Hell no. And that alone is cause enough for worry. The assault on Americans will not end, and you can expect that it will get worse. And the damage is already evident. One other thing. Ask yourself this question. This is essentially where Whitehead was headed. It's where I've headed and why I've done this show, among other things, for years. Where does the First Amendment say the right of the people to peaceably assemble, to petition for redress of grievance, to worship, to speak, and so forth, is dependent on some non-emergency state? It just says Congress shall make no law. Did you get that? Congress shall make no law. They don't have the authority, period, to tell people you can't assemble, you can't worship, you can't travel. All of these things are the rights of free people. And, of course, the point of the Second Amendment is to be able to defend those other rights. All of this already evident. There's a note here in the piece from Barnett. Food shortages, almost certain now. I've been talking about, warning about those for, at least the better part of a year since the fall or the spring of last year, when it was obvious that the planting wasn't happening due to the flooding in the Midwest, due to the, mistakes in California, the socialization that was galloping then, that were causing huge issues with the breadbasket of America when it came to vegetables. And then, of course, you had the bad fall. Hey, those things have already made the food delivery system essentially precarious. And now add this to it? Yeah, we're going to see food riots and chaos at some point. No wonder Big Brother is pulling out the stops. They've already baked that into the cake, too. They're not going to tell you about it any more than they're going to tell you that the engine of the economy has failed. That might cause a stock market collapse. Gee, do you think? Furthermore, I'll read Barnett's comment. Pompeo, the current self-professed lying cretin, calls himself Secretary of State, announced a few days back that this so-called pandemic response is now a live exercise. So active military war games are already taking place, meaning preparations are being made. I've got other stories here that indicate, yes, certain things have already been put in motion. Projects that Newsweek even talked about called Octagon, Freejack, and Zodiac, confirming the military is preparing for widespread chaos, violence, martial law, and all kinds of other good, well, perfectly wonderful ways to use the panic to expand powers. 28 states, and I haven't checked within the last few minutes, but have already called out the National Guard and implemented lockdowns, martial law of one kind or another. No one really knows what's being discussed behind closed doors, but we do know that anything of real importance is being kept secret, and the populace is being treated like mushrooms, right? Keep them in the dark and water them or something. And, of course, let's not forget the possibility, maybe even the likelihood, of forced vaccination. They'll have to claim they have one first, but whether it works or not, remember, doesn't matter. The peons won't have a choice if they get their way, and the panic unfolds as it seems to have been designed to. We're heading into unknown territory, says Barnett. All right, what I thought was kind of interesting, too, was this piece, actually published by a theoretical physicist, a Czech, in fact. Once behind the Iron Curtain, now one of the freer parts of Europe, Dr. Lubo Motl, and I probably butchered that, but it came out of RT News. I saw it on lourockwell.com, and he compares the late American Empire to the late Roman Empire and says, you know what? The West is literally committing suicide. Well, that's why I called it Suicide Watch. No, COVID-19 doesn't spell the end of the world directly, but once the plan comes together, if they have their way, they might be able to succeed in getting that done. What's the real virus threat, though, is, says this particular Czech theoretical physicist, and this is a great observation, is much deadlier. It is the hatred of all values that have underpinned Western civilization for centuries. I'm going to do this article very briefly. It's a pretty good piece. He says, once upon a time I was puzzled as to why the Roman Empire came to an end. No single special devastating event was needed. There are, of course, a number of places where people say, oh, the Rubicon was crossed. The debasement with pot metal resulted in a continued multiple century devaluation of the Roman denarius. All of those things were part of it. But ultimately, it just kind of wound down. It took a long time before the glide path impacted, but sure enough, it happened. And the COVID-19 crisis, or the reaction, demonstrates that people have now grown bored, says Dr. Motl, detached and easily impressionable by things that have nothing to do with the real roots of their society. A large number of Westerners are now happy to accept, get this, the suicidal shutting down of their economies in order to try and halt the spread of a virus that, let's be honest, folks, the time to have done that was 2 months ago. I've been talking about it for longer than that. This thing has an incubation period that says, oh, weeks before people realize that they're spreading it around, they've already spread it around. And I guarantee you, there are 2 weeks or more before we see just how many people have already been infected, and lockdowns and tyrannical measures aren't going to stop what's already baked in the cake. All right, well, just as those people, however, enthusiastically endorse proclamations that there are 46 sexes, not two, that the flatulence of a cow must be reduced, maybe you got to kill the cow in order to save a polar bear, that millions of migrants from the third world, especially those that hate God, the Bible, and the foundations of Western society, must be invited to Europe, to America, and assumed to be neurosurgeons and so on. In other words, insanity is, well, nothing new. We've seen it espoused, taught in the centers of higher indoctrination now for years. And we're reaping the bitter, ugly COVID-19, economic meltdown, you name it, harvest. The widespread opinion, he says, that everything, including economies, must be sacrificed in order to beat the latest booga, 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 is kind of a revival of the medieval witch hunts. The sacrifice seems more important than finding an effective method of dealing with it. Let me put it this way, to go back to my airplane analogy. What we have here is a nation, folks, that would, if it were flying the airplane, the engine fails, and the pilot says, only one way to save us, push the nose down and ram into the earth as hard as we can, and at least it'll be quick. It's idiotic. It's insane. It's government policy. Increasingly, our decadent mass culture has become more ideological. Well, that means anti-God, anti-everything that was once called rule of law, and openly opposed to the values Western civilization was built upon. And instead of being counterculture, now it's a monopoly that uses the information channels to influence, destroy mainstream media and opinions. And people are being sucked into groupthink. That includes leaders. Shutdowns that are already in progress will probably cause the worst recession. He doesn't say it, I will. Depression in history. This might be a worst-case scenario, continues the author. Well, not really, folks. I will suggest that just wait. If I was a bioweapons designer and I had already unleashed part one of a two-part or a three-part binary or trinary weapon, wait until whoever done it introduces part two. Gee, am I serious? Yeah, if you wanted to destroy the United States, if you'd worked so hard to do this, you think you're going to allow right-thinking people to be able to short-circuit what you've put in place and work so hard to gather up? I suspect we're going to see the 1-2 punch real soon now. Anyway, shutdowns will make the Great Depression look like a little walk in the park, and yet, most people, here's where I started, are either unaware, uncaring, or they're just plain happy about it. They don't seem to appreciate the consequent dangers. Instead, they're more obsessed with the latest celebrity who's caught the virus. Riding in the herd, hiding in the herd, running over the cliff with the herd is more important because they're into uniform groupthink. That's good enough for them. And, oh, hey, if a 2-month lockdown isn't enough, well, what the heck? Extend it 6 months, maybe years. A lot of Westerners, they want the policies to last forever. They're just like those so-called leaders that are saying, hey, never let this perfectly good crisis go to waste. We'll implement what Bernie would have done, what the nutcase, empty-headed occasional cortex would have done. And all it took, even though we had a counterculture populist elected to the presidency, he wasn't supposed to win, and so here's plan B. We'll destroy it anyway. And understand, the support for economically suicidal policies hardly started with COVID-19. Westerners have simply gotten decadent amidst a prosperity where they took material wealth and good health care for granted. They expect ever more lucrative entitlements. Hey, we got plenty. Bring them on in. Bring the people from the third world who not only also want to destroy this place but are going to help do it. And let's not forget, we have the right not to be offended, too. He points out that any people who could be led to believe that non-existent man-made global warming was the end of the world, well, is it at all surprising to see that they're truly terrified, booga, 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 of a new disease that has real potential to kill a few million people, especially those that have already been immunocompromised by drinking the Kool-Aid, eating the aspartame and glyphosates and you name it, various types of frankenpoisons that are out there being called food and grown nationwide. The real existential threat of the coronavirus, well, our irrational response to it, is greater than the climate threat, for sure, even if both are arguably small. The real threat, again, the economic meltdown, that one is a done deal, and the global overreaction, Big Brother nationwide. Hey! Build a global new world order on the ashes. Let the phoenix arise out of this. When this inflation of feelings is applied to real threats, like a pandemic, people panic. They lose their composure. And most Westerners, he says, actively seem to want to harm their economies. They want to harm corporations, rich people, governments. They want to harm anybody, and there's part of the root of a bigger problem, because they don't feel any attachment to them or responsibility for them. All they want to do is what any parasite does to the host. Suck them dry, kill them, and then move on. They take their security and prosperity for granted. Money and food arrive from somewhere. They don't care about the source. They're financially illiterate. And they don't realize, here's the bottom line for this piece, that their moral values, their so-called human rights, which they don't even understand, they confuse the right to vote and the right to have free stuff paid for by somebody else with the right to freedom of assembly, worship, speech, to keep and bear arms, to be free of illegal search and seizure. They don't even know what they're giving up. It's conceivable, this fellow concludes, that the West's brush with mortality might lead a few to regain some common sense, wake up, and restore their survival instincts. Maybe a few nations going bankrupt will be a wake-up call. But if people don't pay attention, it's only going to get worse. From here, I want to go on to the real risk that I think is important to prepare for. If you haven't prepared for it by now, by the way, it's probably too late, but let's at least talk about it, because there are implications all over the place. And I'm referring to hyperinflation, and specifically Weimar Germany-style hyperinflation. We had Zimbabwe not long ago. But let me start with this, a piece that came out this morning. The chairman of the unconstitutional Federal Reserve, the money printer extraordinaire Jerome Powell, was on NBC's Today show, and basically, he said a whole bunch of stupid stuff. Oh, we're not writing blank checks. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with the economy. What a lying cretin. Folks, we have a system built on dishonest weights and measures. No fiat currency in history has ever survived, and the dollar has lasted longer than most. It will not. They have the coronavirus excuse now to pull the plug. And here's Powell lying through his teeth and saying we're not writing blank checks. Well, they just wrote $2 trillion of them yesterday. And that's on top of the trillions that they've already repo-madnessed into existence. Folks, the money printing in the United States has never been so extreme. And the results are fundamentally undeniable. Here's the real question that kind of nails it. This empty, vapid talking head finally asked the Fed chair, is there any limit to the amount of money the Fed is willing to put into this economy to keep it afloat? Is it a blank check? Is there any limit? Essentially, he said, this is probably unusual candor, the answer to your question is no, there's no limit. We will print, spin up the helicopters. Folks, we've been talking about this. I've been talking about this for years. The only question was, what was going to do it? Well, now we know. Now, that leads me to the last few minutes today to the story that I've already alluded to, hyperinflation, Weimar Germany. And if you remember, the reason why this is important, of course, is because after World War I and the reparations, a lot of people give excuses for how it happened, but the bottom line is the same. You print money without limit, and you get hyperinflation. And we've seen it any number of times. Now, there's a limit, though, and the limit is what is called by the Austrian school, and that would be primarily people like Ludwig von Mises, who was an Austrian, and that's why it's called Austrian economics or the Austrian school. He witnessed hyperinflation in his own native Austria and also neighboring Germany, and basically was able to help Austria avoid falling into the same pit. What was the answer? Halting the printing press. And he did write this in his memoirs. Austria's currency did not collapse, as did Germany's back in 1923. The crack-up boom, he says, did not occur there. But nevertheless, the country had to bear the destructive consequences of continuing inflation, in other words, money printing, for many years. Its banking, credit, and insurance systems suffered wounds that could no longer heal, and no halt could be put to the consumption of capital. Now, I've used a term that I better explain here, because I will contend that the crack-up boom, as von Mises called it, is the thing that we haven't yet seen, and once we do, it's all over. The engine is out. All right? But I guess what we're, to use the analogy talking about, is the point at which the passengers in the airplane that's gliding to a hard or a soft landing, say in a field somewhere, as opposed to a nice concrete runway, realize that, oh no, the ground's coming up and there's trees out there. And at that point, the die is cast. Well, in the terms of the crack-up boom, different people will explain it different ways. I'll quote Murray Rothbard in a minute, but I like to put it this way. The crack-up boom is when the average Joe, the average Jane, realizes that the so-called money that they've got in their hands or in their wallet will never, ever be worth as much again as it is at this very second. If you've ever played the game of Old Maid, you know what that means. Get rid of it. Use it. Spend it. It's just getting worse. It's like sands through an hourglass. Again, von Mises calls that the crack-up boom. And let's go through a quick summary. We've just got a couple minutes here of hyperinflation in Germany. Wasn't stopped before the complete destruction of the Reichsmark then. And just in case you haven't heard the numbers, before the start of World War I in 1914, it took about, well, a Reichsmark was worth about a quarter. A little over four of them would buy a U.S. dollar. Over the next few years, it got worse. By July 1922, it was 670 of them to buy $1. And by the way, in this era, folks, the dollar was as good as gold. $20 gold piece, Mark Twain called it a double eagle. It was about an ounce of gold. Now, guess how much that is today, right? By end of November 23, when hyperinflation reached its peak, you ready for this? It took 4.2 trillion devalued Reichsmarks to equal the old one quarter worth. So 4.2 trillion to a one was the exchange rate with the dollar. How many people do you think had trillions of Reichsmarks hanging around when all this started? And as a result, here's the other key thing. Hyperinflation is probably one of the most deadly things to a society that you can imagine. And if you haven't been through it, we can't imagine it. But basically, when the currency becomes totally devalued, so do people's responses to one another. In other words, theft, gang rape, murder, you name it. If you think it's bad now in a nation that's forgotten God, wait until they have forgotten that the same God that wrote the book also said, hey, dishonest weights and measures are an abomination. And once they figure that out and the crack-up boom happens, things truly, really get ugly fast. If you've ever seen the Liza Minnelli movie and Joel, what was his name? Anyway, Cabaret. It gives you a clue about some of the decadence that was extant then. And ultimately, that was closer to the peak when the Nazis came into power. And here we are, several years ahead of that. So how much worse do you think it'll get? Hyperinflation, though, is the inevitable consequence of an ever greater rise in the amount of money. And as von Mises noted, and Austrian theory points out, and they're right, inflation is the logical consequence of a rise in the money supply. And hyperinflation, in other words, really, really out of control inflation, is the logical outcome of ever higher growth rates in the money supply. You know, like if, say, the Congress says, let's just print a couple trillion extra dollars and distribute them out like helicopter money to people. Well, when that doesn't happen to be enough, guess what's next? More. Can you pay the debt back? No. Well, even at zero interest rates, and even if the amount of debt isn't growing because of additional interest on the debt, tiny, tiny rates, they're still going to keep having to print it. People hold money because it has purchasing power. And when it doesn't have purchasing power, what's the point of holding it? Mises saw that money demand plays a crucial role for the possibility of unfolding hyperinflation, and once people realize that the money supply is not going to be reined in, the growth is going to continue, they're going to keep doing what they've been doing for a long time and getting away with, but eventually they won't be able to get away with it because it becomes obvious, and then they reach the crack-up boom point. What happens when people expect that in the future, it's just going to get worse? The demand for money, sooner or later, or at least what they thought was money, collapses. And the demand for real stuff, gold and silver, which is real money, suddenly looks really, really good. So once the crack-up boom happens, let's put it this way, it's too late to go out and buy gold and silver. Rothbard put it this way, though. I'm not saying fiat money, once established on the ruins of gold, can't continue, at least for quite a while, but it can't continue indefinitely. Otherwise, I wouldn't have come here to plead for its abolition. The danger is government-controlled fiat money could be held up and running indefinitely. That doesn't necessarily mean the final collapse, but when something happens, and now we've seen the something happen, the rest of the conclusion is kind of like the plane, okay? The engine has quit. We don't know exactly how long it's going to take. You know, maybe several more minutes before things get ugly. But the point is, if we have been planning ahead, folks, if we're prepared, it's no reason to panic. If, on the other hand, we haven't, or if we can't control the descent, or if we allow the people that have already sabotaged the engine to keep on doing it, it's only going to get worse. Finally, the masses wake up, and the breakdown occurs. And a lot of things get really ugly at that point. The goal here, the reason why I spent the time talking about this today, is because they have been working on this, planning this for a long time. The plan is coming together. The engine's out, and the question remains, will people panic? Will they do what they need to do? And yeah, when it comes to talking with your families, this is a good analogy to understand for them too. Most importantly, though, we need to remember that our rights come from our God, not any government of mere men. and the government we once had was instituted among men to protect them, not trample them under a jackboot. And if we don't understand that, it's already too late.